And so we come to the first question, and of course I thank you very much. You have a great many questions. The only thing is, I no longer know whether by the end of the year, I'll manage, at the rate you keep throwing questions at me, to pay off my debt to you. Still, let's look at the first question, and there is something else. I try to answer some of the more substantial questions at a little greater length, that is, with more analysis. And this too is one reason why I may not have time to answer all of your questions. So the first question says, what is love? Thank you. Now, of course, when I tell you to write thank you, 8 out of 10 questions write thank you. Yes, do write it. It is not for my sake, but because it makes us courteous. This is very natural. So, what is love? First of all, man is not the source of love. Pay attention. Perhaps a few points will help you grasp this matter. Man is not the source of love. Just as he is not the source of other things either. Just as the moon takes its light from elsewhere, receiving its light from the sun, so too man receives from God all these remarkable qualities, which, as we'll see a little further on, are called the divine, uncreated energies of God. The source of love, then, is God. Let's look at how Saint Isaac the Syrian puts this in his 33rd homily. Love that has God as its cause is like a spring that gushes forth, and its streams are never cut off. For he alone is the source of love, and its substance never fails. Love, he says, has God as its cause. It is a spring that always wells up, and its streams never stop and are never cut off. For God alone is the source of love, and he is the very matter of love that is never spent. This is what the evangelist John says. God is love. Of course, when he says God is love, he doesn't mean something that refers to the essence of God in the sense that the essence of God is revealed to us. It is an energy of God, the love of God. So, then, the source of love is God. Now, all the energies of God spring from the essence of God, and these two are uncreated. That is, uncreated, not made. Pay attention to this point when you grow older, or if related questions happen to come up around this matter. We could say something more about it. The energy of God is uncreated. Every energy, just as the essence of God is uncreated, God is uncreated. No one made him, to put it in plain Greek. No one fashioned God. So God is self-existent. God is unbegotten. No one brought him forth his essence. Then is eternal, existing without beginning and without end, which is something inconceivable. And so his energies, too, are uncreated. So what happens? Take the sun, to give an example so that we may understand something. The sun is a fiery mass. At the same time, though, this mass, if we call it the essence of God, has all the radiance that pours out into the surroundings of the sun, let's say, which is the energy of God. This light of the sun that we have, which comes to the earth, starts from the sun. Obviously, it starts from the sun, but it also comes from the essence of the sun, we might say. So, as it is with the sun, so it is with God too. The energies of God start from the essence of God, and just as the essence of God is uncreated, the energies of God are also uncreated. One of God's energies is love, just one, because we have many energies. Now, the uncreated energy of God, like the radiation of the sun, falls everywhere. It falls also upon human hearts. And what happens when the ray, the uncreated energy, the ray of God's love, falls upon a heart? Then the heart has a property from the way it was made, by its very construction. It is a mirror, a looking glass. Just as a ray of light, falls and is reflected, and turns back again. What does this mean? That it turns back. It means that when the uncreated energy of God falls upon my heart, his love, then I respond, and I begin to love God. So I am not the source of love. The source of love is God. I simply respond. But you'll ask me, why are there people who love and people who do not love God? Quite simply, it is this. Says Theophilos of Antioch. It depends on the mirror of your heart. If, he says, the mirror of your heart is covered with rust, that is, ios in Greek, which means rust and also poison with rust, then how will that mirror reflect the light? Impossible. This means that the heart becomes rusted through the passions. The rust of the heart is the passions, it is sins. So when I enter into the realm of the passions of egotism, self-interest, and so on, then my heart is no longer able to reflect the uncreated divine energy of God, which is love. And what happens? I do not love. If I am to love, what must I do? I must begin to cleanse my heart. This is why, in the Fathers, love is said to be the fruit of the purification of the heart. Or, if you prefer to put it even better, when the Fathers speak of purity of heart, they mean love. Or take other speeches. The speeches of orators who spoke in court, or who spoke before important persons, and wanted to achieve something. In their introduction, they always praise the person who would listen to them, or the judge, or the court. We should know this. It is very important, because we gain the goodwill of our listener, of the court, of the ruler, of the king, of the minister, whoever it may be. We do not go in and insult him. We do not go in like that and say, "You know, we want this." That is improper, and it is not courteous either. What does the Apostle Paul say? "So that I may establish this point for you, and so that you do not think this is a matter of flattery." The criterion, then, of true, genuine, saving love is purity of heart. Let us not forget this. That is why we must practice ascesis, my children, so as to cleanse our heart. When I tell you, or when your spiritual father tells you, wherever it may be, read a book, don't sit watching television. But why? Because otherwise, you will never cleanse your heart. Don't sit listening to the filthy things other people say, otherwise you will never cleanse your heart. Now, some people say, "But I don't actually commit any sinful acts." You may not be committing such acts now, but you will. A day will come when you will commit them too. When you are not cleansing your heart, what is the gain? There is no gain at all in merely saying, "I don't commit any acts." We must have purity of heart. Let us understand this. And purity of heart, of course, has both a negative and a positive side, what I must not do and what I must do. But I will not dwell on this too much, because these are not subjects for full talks. These are questions, and I must answer briefly, as I told you, so that I can answer as many questions as possible. I will only tell you the marks of love, of genuine and true love, as Saint Isaac the Syrian records them for us in his 81st homily. I regard this passage in that homily as the most beautiful one in all the homilies of Saint Isaac the Syrian. Listen, of course, I am leaving some things out. To make it shorter, he has more there. And what is a merciful heart? Merciful means loving. And what is the heart that loves? Listen, what now is the heart that loves, rightly, genuinely? A burning of the heart. A burning of the heart. Burning means being set on fire, the heart being kindled into flame. But for what? For the whole of created nature, for all created nature, for human beings, and birds, and animals, and demons, and for every creature. When your heart is set aflame for all things, you will say to me, "How? Pay attention. This, how cannot be taught. These are matters of experience. They are experiences. If you ask me what Rapsani wine tastes like, I will tell you, taste it and see what it tastes like. How can I describe it to you? I can tell you its color, because I see it. But to a blind man, we cannot speak about color. And there too, it is a matter of experience. Tastes are something you experience. These things can't be described, they have to be tasted. So what does it mean here? This burning for the whole of creation. For the whole of God's creation. My friends, it is something else entirely. It is something else. For human beings. For all human beings. And then for the birds, for the animals. Listen to this example. When someone sees, in a harsh winter, the little birds no longer able to find food. I remember once, more than 18 years ago now, somewhere around 1967, there was a terrible, bitter winter in Larissa, 1966. Somewhere around there. I don't remember exactly. The snow lasted a whole month, and here in our region, a great many birds had died. When a person sees creation suffering, a burning of the heart begins to take hold of him, and all the more so when he knows that this winter has someone responsible for it. God is not the one responsible. Man is, because I sinned in the paradise of God. I am the one who ruined creation, so that creation suffers. Otherwise, God does not make imperfect things. It was I who ruined creation. So if the harsh winter was so excessive that the birds froze and died, I, man, with my continual sins, am the cause. Do you see this? Then he speaks of love even for the demons. You'll ask me, how can someone have love even there? How can I explain it to you? How? The one who has a pure heart sees the workings of Satan, and what does he say? Wretched creature, he says, to Satan, to the demons. Wretched creatures. Wretched creatures who cannot love. Wretched creatures who cannot love. Wretched creatures who cannot humble yourselves. Wretched creatures who are bound for hell. Oh, wretched creatures who cannot repent. Just as we say of a man who does not repent, we tell him, wretched man, you cannot repent. So too, we say it of the demons. So one can say this, and it is truly without equal. The way Saint Isaac the Syrian sets it forth here, and he continues. And from the memory of them, simply from remembering them, and from beholding them, or seeing them, his eyes run with tears, tears stream from his eyes. And because of this, at every hour, at every moment, he offers up prayer with tears. At every moment, he offers prayer with tears. At every moment, he offers prayer with tears. That they may be preserved, that the creatures may be kept safe, out of his great mercy, which moves in his heart without measure, in the likeness of God. In other words, he is moved without measure in love, resembling God. This is a supreme thing. These are the highest marks of love. So, let us take care, my friends, not to seek love in dirty things, nor in low things. Let us go straight to the wellspring, knowing that we must purify our heart, so that it may respond to the source of love, to God, so that we may love rightly. Pay attention to me, rightly. Many times we see, women especially, who tell you, pay attention to this point. I want to be loved, and to have their love shown to me. Why do you want to be loved? Don't you think you're becoming self-centered? And that this is therefore egotism. Not only to be loved, but also to have it shown to you. See to it that you yourself love. And then you will understand who, what love is. But so that we may understand it, and not fall into sickly forms. This is why I have told you these things, so that we may understand how we ought to position ourselves. Furthermore, my friends, love must answer to the intellect, to the feelings, and to the will. Take note, love is not a fruit of the heart alone. It is a fruit of the whole person. Remember what the first commandment says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your mind, and with all your strength, and with all your heart. What does this mean? It means to love God with my intellect, to know why I love him, to love God with my heart, with my feelings, but also with my will. That is, to act fittingly and in response to the love of God, for when I love, I will respond. And it is the will that will make me respond to the love of God. And so we have love that is right, the love that makes a person happy, and above all the love that saves. This, my friends, is evangelical love. And now I come to another question. It says, is the church for or against the donation of the body? It means, of course, the donation of bodily organs. That is, to give my kidney, to give my eye or my eyes. To give, I don't know what else. My heart, of course we can say this, or my blood. If you like, we can say that some elements a person may give after death. That is, once he has died, once he dies and is, as we say, clinically dead, as medicine puts it, that they take his organs, his heart, that they take his kidneys, that they take his eyes, that they take his eyes, that they take them and transplant them into a living person who has no eyes, or who is waiting for a kidney in order to live as well, or for a damaged heart to be renewed, his heart, or before death, as with blood donation. We do not die to give our blood. We give our blood while we are alive. Likewise, a person can give certain organs even while he is still alive, as in giving one of his kidneys. I recall, many, many years ago, it is about 30 years from today now, indeed it stirred worldwide emotion. There was a young builder, 17 years old, this was in France, and he climbed up onto some scaffolding, fell down, struck himself, and struck his kidney. But it was discovered that from birth he had only one kidney. Now he had struck that one too, so he had no chance of surviving. And his mother, because of the blood relation, since of course one must give, but it has to match, I don't know much more. But I tell you, these are matters of a medical nature. She offered to give one of her kidneys, and she did give one of her kidneys to be transplanted into her child. Of course, sadly, this young man died. That operation did not succeed. I am telling you this only as an example. While still alive, someone gave an organ of the body, such as a kidney. Or someone may even give one of his eyes, certainly, and say, I will live with one eye, and I give my other eye to another human being. This is why, my friends, the offering of bodily organs is an act of great and uncommon love, without any doubt. To the question of whether the church is for or against, you understand it, you see it very clearly. Let us not forget that to give of myself what I can, even my blood and so on, is an imitation of Jesus Christ, who offered himself for the world. From the Gerontocon, or rather I take it from St. Isaac the Syrian, from his 81st homily, the following, it is sublime. Take note, Abba Agathon used to say that he wished to find a leper and to take that man's body and to give him his own. And St. Isaac the Syrian adds, did you see perfect love? And why do I say these things? Many of them gave over their own bodies to the wild beasts, and to the sword, and to the fire for the sake of their neighbor. It is very beautiful. Take note, Abba. Father Agathon used to say, I wish to find a leper, and to take his body, and to give him my own. That is, to take his whole body, impossible, of course. But when he says to take his entire body, and to give him my own body, he was expressing his great love. And here, Saint Isaac says, did you see perfect love? And why do I say this? There are many who gave themselves over to the wild beasts, and to the sword, and to the fire solely to show their love for their neighbor. This is why, my friends, we would say it is indeed an act of heroism, an act of love, to offer something of oneself. So much for this question, and I come to another question. Is it not preferable to burn the dead rather than to bury them? Would the church readily adopt such a law? Indeed, pay attention. My friends, let us turn to this point. It is an ancient and universal custom, a habit that is burial of the dead and not cremation of the dead. Consequently, it is first of all a custom, a habit, of all peoples, of all eras, burial. And burial is also the more natural, that is, something that no longer lives upon the earth, decomposes, whether it is buried or whether it decomposes on the surface of the earth, and nothing more. Cremation, on the other hand, is not a natural act. The more natural case is burial. Cremation, nevertheless, was used by a few peoples much later on. The Egyptians, for example, never burned their dead. As is well known, we find them today mummified, that is, embalmed, and we find these people preserved. We find them preserved. Cremation among the Egyptians is not the practice, and among the Greeks, there was no cremation, except perhaps in a few cases. But ordinarily, we do not have cremation, but burial. Among Christians, burial prevails, not only because Christ was buried, but also because, or we might even say, that cremation would obstruct the resurrection of the dead. Would anyone really conceive of saying that if I burn a dead body, he will not rise again? It is absurd. Indeed, to secure this point for you, from Revelation 20:14, it says the following, and the sea gave up the dead that were in it, and death and Hades gave up the dead that were in them, and the fire too, will give back the bodies. And the water and the sea will give back the bodies. In other words, the body, in reality, as matter, is not lost. Now, how God will gather this matter and reconstitute the human body is a matter of his wisdom and his love and his power. That is not our concern. The point is that the resurrection of the dead is not prevented by cremation. But pay attention, burial brings us in an image closer to faith in the resurrection of the dead. When we put wheat in the kaliva, why do we put the wheat there? It also has a scriptural origin to remind us of the resurrection of the dead. Just as the wheat falls into the earth and sprouts and comes up, and what else? And so, the Apostle Paul says, it is sown in corruption and raised in incorruption, that is, man is raised incorrupt, just like the grain of wheat. Notice, when we say an iconic case, we mean a symbol, an image. When we bury the dead, it is an image that he will rise again. That is why we use the verb, forgive me, I have fallen asleep, I am sleeping, meaning I die, or I have died. We don't say I die, or I have died. We don't say graveyard, we say coimeterion, a place of sleeping. And the one who sleeps is not burned, he is not ashes. He is sleeping, and he will wake up. So for reasons of image, of representation, of symbol of the resurrection of the dead are buried, and the dead must never be cremated. Cremation is what the pantheists prefer, and those who set themselves against, listen to me, against the resurrection of the dead. It is something telling. Let me remind you of two persons, Greeks, Unfortunately, they are not few, of course. But I will remind you only of two well-known persons. Dimitri Mitropoulos, that orchestra conductor, whose conducting you may have heard in classical music. He wanted to be cremated. And Maria Callas, that singer, she too wanted to be cremated. She left it in her will to be cremated. This thing, children, stands against, we would say, against the orthodox teaching concerning the resurrection of the dead. Not because the dead will not rise, I say it again, but because we have before us the image of the resurrection through burial. And so the church will never accept the cremation of the dead in place of the burial of the dead. If someone is an unbeliever, a pantheist, whatever you wish to call it, and he himself asks to be cremated, then of course he has no relation to the church. This is what I wanted to tell you about the third question as well. And, God willing, we will continue this coming Sunday. There is a first question that says, does man today agree with the likening to God that Holy Scripture speaks of? And if not, why? Indeed, as you will remember from our lessons last year, which were anthropological and drawn from the first three chapters of Genesis, we saw that man is fashioned in the image of God. His calling is to attain the likeness. The image is man's dowry. What has been given to him, the necessary conditions. The likeness is the goal. Earlier in our lesson, we were saying that Christianity is hope, and that the meaning of existence is given only by Christianity. What is the meaning of existence? To become. To pass from the image to the likeness, or, by the power of the image, to become the likeness. That is why Christ says, be therefore perfect, as your Father in heaven is perfect. Become perfect as your Father is perfect. That is, reach and bring to fulfillment the likeness. If we do not bring the likeness to fulfillment, we cannot enter the kingdom of God. But let us not be discouraged, for perhaps someone will say, but how will I do it? Little by little, by the grace of God, with the help of God. Just as a little child in the first grade should not be discouraged about how he will become a lawyer or a doctor, and how, sir, he will ever read those weighty books, so too, I think. The one who first sees the way he must struggle and walk the road of life, of the spiritual life, should not be discouraged. But this is still the truth. We must reach there. So the question says, today, does a person reach the point of actualizing the according to the likeness, that is, becoming like God by grace? But it seems that the one asking already senses that today this is not being realized. And that is why he asks, why? My children, we have said what our purpose is. Do you know what the situation is like regarding this question? It is as if we stop at a crossroads for a moment and ask how to get to where we are seeking. And someone comes along and tells us, you will take this road and you will go there. And it will turn out this way. You will find that. And so on. And yet, we do not set out, but stand idly gawking at that crossroads. The man told us plainly, take this road, and you will get there. This is what our age is like, my children. Our age does not want to walk the path of likeness to God, but wants to walk the path of its own choosing. Besides, let us not forget that in order to walk the path of likeness to God, one must have a model. What does likeness mean? It means I have to have the model I am going to come to resemble. Today we have torn that model down. Today we say that anything established is of no use to us. It is a tragedy that we have turned God into the establishment. But I wonder why we did not also make the sun the establishment. I wonder why we did not make water the establishment. And bread, why did we not make bread the establishment? Why has no one said that bread is the establishment? That we will never eat bread again? The sun is the establishment. So let us not let it rise again. And because it has the audacity to rise every morning, we will go and hide in basements and mouse holes so as not to see it, because we would want to sit in judgment on it and brand it the establishment. Do you not think these things are foolish? We made God into an institution and decided that we no longer need him, that he has reigned over humanity long enough, that it is time to tear down his idol and clear him out of the way. So we removed God. We speak of atheism. We say we believe in nothing. No, we do not believe in Jesus Christ. We believe in nothing. Tell me, please, if we remove the model, is it ever possible anymore to speak about imitation? For being according to the likeness is nothing other than imitation of the prototype. I am the antitype, and I must come to resemble the prototype. But the prototype is no longer there. We have thrown it away. We must return again to the prototype, so that we may attain the according to the likeness. Find the meaning of our existence, the purpose of our life. Truly find ourselves and give worth to our existence, and be found in the kingdom of God. This is the reason why today there is no likeness. But if you would ask, why did we remove God? Did we grow tired of Him? Hear my supplication and have mercy on your inheritance. Listen, O Lord, hear and answer. Pay attention, it is hear and answer. Epikouo, epsilon, pi, epikouo, not hypokouo, obey. Just as we say, gorgopikous, quick to hear, though some people say gorgopikous, quick to obey. In other words, does the Panagia come quickly to obey you? No, not to obey, but to hear and answer. The Panagia is not under our command. We entreat her, we beg her, to hear us quickly. Therefore, she is gorgopikous, quick to hear. Not gorgopikous, quick to obey, that is wrong. Of course, it is blasphemy to call her quick to obey. But because God knows, because God is good, He knows that we are unlearned. Well then, do you not think that our age is sick, and indeed gravely sick, when it reaches the point of thinking this way and acting this way? Yes, children, our age is sick. You will say to me, are all people sick? No, no. At least, presumably, you who come here must be very careful indeed, not to fall ill, for all of us can fall ill. Yes, all of us, do not be surprised. Even I, who am speaking to you, may fall ill. What do I mean by falling ill? Not the ordinary illnesses, but this illness. Which illness, reaching the point of saying, children, that God too is an institution, a falling ill and throwing God away. God forbid, may God protect us. That is why, in the midst of this famished condition, this famine, this sickened state, let us take care to keep ourselves healthy, so that we can find the meaning of our existence, which is the fulfillment of the likeness, are being made according to the likeness of God. And now I come to another question. Of course, I don't know whether it is a boy or a girl who is putting it to me. But I mention it because it seems to me more likely that it would be a girl asking this question. That may seem strange to you. Still, I rather think it is a girl who is asking, is smoking a sin? And if so, why? Apart from reasons of health, which I know and which you yourselves know as well, should I give my answer on the grounds of health, or should I not answer that way? So then, is smoking a sin, yes or no, and why? What is smoking? You know what a cigarette is. You've all seen a cigarette. You've seen a cigarette in your life. You've seen cigarettes. You've held them in your hands. Did you ever open a pack? Did it ever, perhaps, make its way to your mouth? My children, just yesterday, someone was telling me, he had read it somewhere, in a student paper, from some statistic. I do not know whether it was from the provinces, but the provinces are not behind the capital. 92% of middle school students, not high school students, middle school students, have smoked or are smoking. 92%, an overwhelming figure, we would say, an overwhelming number. 92%, as I told you, have either smoked or do smoke. So you have seen cigarettes. You know what they are? Children, you know what a cigarette is. It comes from a plant. And you know this because here in Greece and in our own region, we cultivate tobacco. Most likely your parents have fields with tobacco, and very likely you yourselves help with cultivating it. You know it, is a yearly plant. It grows to at most about 1 meter, a little more or a little less, depending on how much water we give it. It has broad leaves, we dry them, the factories cut them, they put them inside paper. They give it the familiar shape of the cigarette. We set a fire to it there. We make it smoke. It turns into smoke, and we begin to draw the smoke inside us. Surely, surely, if for a moment an ancient man rose from his grave and saw people smoking, it would seem to him the strangest thing of all. That is, a person becomes a little brazier, lacking only the chimney, for as someone once cleverly said, if God had made us in order to smoke, there would have had to be a chimney over our heads as well, so that the smoke could escape from there. And yet, children, precisely because we've grown accustomed to this strange phenomenon, today it makes no impression on us. I say it once more, look at it with virgin eyes, with objective eyes, with the eyes of an ancient person who had appeared from the olden age. The phenomenon will seem very strange to you, that a person sets fire to something, to a plant, sets fire to it and draws in the smoke. It is a very odd phenomenon. You know, too, that tobacco came from America. Furthermore, it was of course first cultivated in Spain and then in France. Tobacco contains a poison, nicotine. It was named in honor of a Frenchman who cultivated this plant, whose name was Nicotin. Nico, but it isn't pronounced fully because there is no E at the end. Nico, nicotine. This man studied the plant, cultivated it, and so on. With lightning speed, despite the great reservations, we might say that peoples had toward this thing, this phenomenon. It spread throughout the whole world. In Persia, for example, anyone who smoked was condemned to death. Of course, now all our friends smoke, everyone smokes, but what is this, after all? First of all, smoking became connected with a person's ethos, with his moral character. Let us look at this in answering the question. It was connected with moral character. In other words, in earlier times, when we saw a child, not an adult, because that did not surprise us, but a child, a student of secondary school age, it was unthinkable. In my own time, when I was a student, if someone wanted to smoke, he would go, I don't know, to the ends of the earth in order to smoke. If a teacher saw him smoking, it meant expulsion from school. They would go to smoke in the changing rooms, in the lavatories of the school, and so on. And those who would smoke, out of 500 or 1,000 children, were hardly 5 children among them. Hardly. So, when we once saw a child smoking, we connected the fact with his whole moral character. For this child might well have a father who smoked, whose father did smoke or does smoke. But no child smoked because his father smoked. We didn't learn the cigarette from our father, nor from our mother, for back then women didn't smoke except a very few women smoked, in the old days. Whereas today, unfortunately, more do. No child learned to smoke because his father smokes, but he smoked because he fell into bad company. That is where the child learned the cigarette. Consequently, it was bound up with one's moral character. If we saw a child smoking, we would say, this child doesn't keep good company. And therefore, it is a sign that it is not only that he learned to smoke, he has other things to his account that are unpleasant. This child isn't doing well. His moral character is beginning to wear down. To spoil, he isn't doing well. Thus it was considered improper, ignoble, even immoral, to see a child, a young person, smoking. Indeed, in front of his father, it was an unthinkable thing. In front of his teacher, his instructor, an unthinkable thing. But this doesn't cease to be in truth, even if everything has been leveled, something bound up with moral character. Today, if I see a pupil, don't tell me that I belong to an old era. I will say, this child isn't doing well. However many arguments he piles up that he is doing well, I will answer him, you're not doing well. And all the more, so if it is a girl, I will tell her, you're not doing well, certainly. But the question says, is the cigarette a sin, carrying the poison of nicotine? It creates problems. Problems for one's health, beyond the matter that it is bound up with moral character. It creates problems for one's health. What problems? Nicotine poisons the blood, and the heart suffers harm. This is why we have very many heart conditions from smokers. This is why someone who has a heart condition and goes to the doctor, and the doctor asks him whether he smokes, will be told not to smoke. Smoking is not permitted for someone who has a heart problem, for the reason I explained to you. And there is something else. A cigarette produces tar. You see it in a pipe. In the filter, whatever they put there, I do not know, the tar collects there. Tar is carcinogenic, and as a carcinogenic substance, tar creates the conditions for cancer. This is why we get cancer of the tongue, the throat, the esophagus, the stomach, and the lungs. And here is something that will seem strange to you, something I didn't know and only asked about recently. The smoker is also at risk of cancer of the bladder. When I asked how this could be and why, I was told that this tar circulates in the blood. How does it get into the blood? I smoke. And it goes to the lungs. The lungs expose the blood to take in oxygen. But they also take in the tar. And the tar circulates. And the blood, in order to be cleansed, passes through the kidneys. So the kidneys retain the tar, like filters that they are. and they pass the tar along with the urine into the bladder. And as the tar remains there, in the bladder develops cancer. A third factor, the cigarette produces carbon monoxide, which is likewise a poison. And while on the one hand we talk about how the environment we live in is polluted, saying exhaust fumes, and exhaust fumes, in reality we are already creating a polluted environment with the cigarette. These three things, carbon monoxide, nicotine, and tar, do very great harm to one's health. It is said that of 8 people who get lung cancer, 1 does not smoke and the rest were smokers. It is also said that when someone smokes, his life is shortened by 10 years. If he was going to live to 60, he dies at 50. So, pay attention. Apart from the matter of sudden illness, cancer, and the like, of heart disease, even if he doesn't suffer those, there is still simply the wearing down of the body. And now we ask, if health is worn down, and I'm not even speaking now about how the cigarette is bound up with one's character, you might tell me times change. You might tell me that this was considered a superstition about the matter. But let us set those aside and keep only the question of health. I ask, if my health is worn down because I smoke, not to mention that other thing, that if a woman smokes, you know, there is a great danger when a woman smokes while she is pregnant. She damages. She destroys the embryo. The embryo will be harmed. There is an association here, St. Stylianos, connected with that school for children with difficulties and so on and so forth. And they have published a leaflet which says there that when a pregnant woman smokes, there is a great likelihood the child will be born spastic. Imagine having a spastic child for a whole lifetime, and in any form, to any degree of spasticity, from the mildest form to the most severe. Would you ever want, tomorrow, to become parents and have spastic children? And why? Because the wife, the woman, smoked while she was pregnant. If you tell me, well, let her not smoke while she is pregnant. But when she has smoked since she was a schoolgirl, and it has become a passion, come now and tell me to get rid of that passion. Does it come out, or doesn't it? And why doesn't it come out? It doesn't come out because inside the cigarette it has, what do you think it has? It has a narcotic. I'm not even speaking about the added narcotic. It is said, I don't know. I did no analysis. I heard it and saw it written that these cigarettes, the Marlboro, as they are called, something like that, these cigarettes, which the youth above all buy, these cigarettes have inside them. They have added narcotics inside them. That is why the advertisement says whoever smokes, smokes again, like Coca-Cola. Whoever drinks, drinks again. Why? Because it has a small dose of narcotic inside it. And it is for precisely this reason that there is an attraction toward it. But what happens with this narcotic? The body becomes addicted to narcotics. And so I return to my previous subject, to the previous point, that the children, the poor things, what fault is it of theirs that they will be born abnormal, will be born spastic, with broken health? Not to mention the other main thing, that inside the house, when the mother and the father smoke, the children smoke too. In what sense? They breathe in the cigarette, and it is considered more harmful to smoke the smoke that is in your environment than to have smoked yourself. You will have seen some advertisements that the prefecture put up. They had placed them everywhere, where there is a little child sitting on its stool, that little child's stool, with a cigarette in its mouth. One would say how, and it says underneath, when you smoke inside the house, your child breathes in the smoke. It is as if it is smoking, and you understand how great the harm is. All these things destroy one's health. And I ask, children, I ask, if health is destroyed, if life is shortened, is this not deliberate, self-willed suicide? Most certainly yes. And if it is suicide, since life is a gift of God, is it not a sin? So obviously it is a sin. The conclusion, when I smoke, I sin. I sin against myself, the smoker says to God, against my own self, but also against those around me. Tell me, why should I die young, when my children are depending on me? Why should society lose me, if I am a worthwhile person, and I die early, because I smoke? So it is a sin. It is as if we are saying to God, you gave us the gift of life and the gift of health, and we throw these gifts back in your face. A terrible thing. And one more thing. Earlier, we spoke of that little bit of narcotic the cigarette has inside it. You know that. In our day, the very greatest danger is drugs. that we do not know where this danger will end up. It is as if a river has flooded, and we do not know where to gather it from. What are we to do, information campaigns? The campaign makes no impact, whatever you may say now to the children. The campaign does nothing. Perhaps some child understands something, and so on. Nothing comes of the campaign. They shout information. Information. I don't think so. The climate of the age is so strong that our children are even trying narcotics. I tell you, as far as I can know, students of course of the high school and of the gymnasium, not to mention even of the primary school, I won't say that to you, already, not of course, at the 92% rate, as with the cigarette, but already, they have tried narcotics. And when someone tries it only once, do not forget that the narcotic, because it irritates the nervous system, leaves a memory. Just as a computer has a memory, I can press a memory button, and it brings us back the result. Then we can do other operations. We press the memory button again, and it brings it back to us. That is, if a child, and don't be discouraged by what I'm telling you, but I cannot fail to tell you, took a narcotic only one single time. Only one single time. No one guarantees for the future that this child, as it grows up, will not at some point return to this matter. You know that, at some point, just as the cigarette leaves a memory, it leaves a memory. You quit the cigarette sometimes for decades. You may have smoked as an adolescent and never smoke again. And at some point in your 50s, in your 60s, something happens to you, some difficulty and so on. And what do? You remember it again, and suddenly you are smoking because it left a memory. How much more the narcotic? So I tell you this. When a child smokes, it creates a bridge to narcotics. A bridge, not in the sense that they will put the narcotic into it and give it to him so that he may begin to love narcotics, but also because the cigarette is the introduction to narcotics. A child that begins to feel these pleasures, such as the cigarette, will not find it difficult tomorrow to use narcotics as well. So what is the cigarette, besides the other things we have said? An access, a bridge toward narcotics. Children, my good children, I advise you and I beg you, if any child has smoked, let him not smoke again. And if he has not smoked, let him say, "My God, keep me, may I never put such things into me."